Welcome back to the Better Way podcast, brought to you by RNG Insights Lab. This is a curiosity podcast where we ask, there has to be a better way, right? There just has to be. I'm Zach Kosalia, the co-founder of RNG Insights Lab, and I am joined, as always, by the one and only Hui Chen. Hi, Hui.
Hi, Zach. How are you today?
I am good. I am super excited because we have another internal guest and another repeat guest in David Yanofsky. David, welcome to the podcast.
Hey, Zach. Hey, Hui.
David, why don't you just reintroduce yourself to our listeners?
I'm David Yanofsky. I run the lab's data visualization and data analysis practice. And prior to doing that, I spent a number of years in journalism, investigating and trying to understand companies from the outside rather than from the inside.
Terrific. We're going to talk today about a topic we explored with you on your first visit to the podcast, which is data storytelling. But we're going to dig a little bit deeper. David, one of my favorite parts of your original time on the podcast was you introducing us to the concept of precision journalism, and then us sort of adopting that phrase for precision compliance or precision DEI or precision fill in the blank. Why don't you remind folks about precision journalism and your work as a journalist prior to joining the lab?
Yeah, so precision journalism, which is also referred to more colloquially as data journalism, is using quantitative social science methods to report on the world around you. And so it's using data that already exists. It's collecting data that you don't have and applying scientific methods, statistical methods to it to learn about your community or the economy or whatever else you're reporting on. And that's what I was doing. I did that most recently at Quartz and prior to that at Bloomberg.
You say that data storytelling is just storytelling, but with data. Talk to us about what you mean by that and how we can make the concept of data storytelling just more kind of relatable to those of us who probably are in the business of telling stories in one way or another every day.
And there are folks who need to communicate metrics and successes of their business unit, of their group, of their whatever their work is. As soon as you have a manager, a culture in your organization or an otherwise business demand to start quantifying those successes and areas that could use improvement, people really struggle on how to continue to tell that story in as specific amount of terms as you get with numbers. I say data storytelling is just storytelling because in journalism, your journalism doesn't get better or worse just because you've added a number, or just because you've added a number, it doesn't change the requirements of what you need to communicate to your audience. It's another detail. It's another fact. It's another venue to reinforce the ideas and the concepts that you're trying to convey to people who may be more predisposed to understanding the success of something as a percentage increase, the success of something through a chart instead of through a sentence or through a feeling.
There are other careers I might have gone into had I been more comfortable with numbers. And I think your concept of telling a story with data is really new with a lot of people, because in certainly the compliance field, many of the people working in the field are just beginning to get introduced to the idea of data analytics. And I think many of them are still struggling with what that is. And then you layer on top, you know, not only you have to analyze, but you have to tell story. And I think that can feel very overwhelming to a lot of people. So hence, I think a lot of times compliance presentations, you just get this rows and rows of data. And it's difficult for both the presenter and the audience to easily make sense of it. And this is where a lot of what you call visualization comes into play. Whereas, you know, I'm looking at a massive spreadsheet with lots of fields and numbers. I don't know what to make of it. Yet, this is where when you do the right visualization, you can see that spike in the trend, or you can see a lot of dense points in a particular area. And that's when you start making sense of some of these things. To the people who are struggling, what would be the first couple of steps that you would advise them to do in terms of helping to transform this data dump into data storytelling?
Good stories have beginnings, middles, and ends. You need to know what you want to tell people. You have to introduce the issues and then introduce those issues to your audience. You need to capture their attention. You need to set expectations in a beginning. In a middle, you need to provide details, what's happening. You need to communicate status and trend, maybe discuss challenges. And in the end, you want to summarize, ensure that your points are being made, reinforce the reason why you're communicating this stuff to begin with, and perhaps even have a call to action. You're giving someone this information for a reason, and you want them to be able to now take an action because of it. That's just a normal storytelling arc. But to your point, Wei, about like not being comfortable, you see a big spreadsheet full of numbers and you just don't get it. Or you see some charts and you're confused by them. When I think of folks who have that discomfort, I try and remind them that they look at the weather report every morning and that they might open the newspaper to a big page of tiny numbers that just fills the entire broadsheet of a newspaper. And there's all sorts of maps, charts, and data visualizations, and the text is tiny. And but you can look at that and you can understand the story that it's telling. You can understand by looking at all of that data and picking out exact visualizations that are relevant for you, or the right metrics, that you can answer lots of questions about the day. What am I supposed to wear today? Am I going to be able to exercise outside today? Should I walk to work? Do I need an umbrella? All of these things are just based on the numbers that are on that page. Not everyone reads the newspaper. Some people get their weather report from, say, the local TV station. And there you have someone presenting all of that information to you. You have someone standing in front of a lot of the same data, pointing out all of the various features of it and telling a story about the weather of the day based on the data that's coming in. That is a completely data-focused story that that people are used to either proactively consuming or passively consuming on a near daily basis. And so have confidence in your ability to understand stories with numbers because you're already doing it.
I love that analogy because to me, it's very easily applicable to compliance. When you're looking at a lot of these data, what you want to know is there a storm coming? Is there a part of our program that's particularly susceptible to certain type of risk that I want to fortify that?
One of the things that I really like about storytelling as a device for helping maybe the uncomfortable get more comfortable is that it's not only a device that helps us think about the way in which we're going to present the data. I actually use it as a way to start reframing the discussion on the front end about what we need to be telling stories about at all. We talk to some of our stakeholders, some of our clients, some of our friends in this space, and I hear folks starting the conversation around things like, well, we have X number of ERP systems and this one communicates with that one and this one doesn't communicate with the other. And then we have a bunch of data in Excel spreadsheets. And then we want to get access to our HR data, but we don't have access to that. And there's political landmines associated with getting that. And we don't have systems set up for this, but we have systems set up for that. And what winds up happening is a swirl arises that prevents folks from making progress. And so rather than starting the conversation around, well, what data sources do we need? What data sources are connected? Or talking explicitly about data, I always try to reframe the question of just simply, what story do you want to be able to tell? Because when you start the conversation about data, you wind up ending the conversation with just a dump of data, of numbers, of that experience that you described, Wei, looking at the Excel spreadsheet, when in reality, when you just start by, well, what stories do we have to tell or what stories do we want to be able to tell? We're naturally putting ourselves on the right path to creating the kind of final work product that ultimately is going to bring value to the stakeholder, that's going to be actionable. And that isn't going to be susceptible to the so what factor, which all too often winds up getting in the way of meaningful data-driven analytics progress.
Also, the story concept may be very helpful to the people who ask Zach and me a lot of this question about what kind of data should we be looking at? Everybody tells me I have to be doing data analytics. I mean, I don't know what data should I be looking at other than the traditional ones of like how many people are under investigation, how many cases are closed and open, how many people completed training. And when you start talking about data as a story, when it's reframed that way, you start asking the questions that would help you build the story. So if you look at this one set of data of here's how many investigations the company has completed, and you know, the traditional breakdown, like by business units, by geography, that's pretty much how far most of the compliance data analytics go. But when you start thinking about it, how do you put a story together about investigations? So it's the traditional who, what, when, where, why, right? Well, who is committing these misconducts? Is it people who are senior in the company? So besides the geographical breakdown, the business unit breakdown, there's a lot of demographic information that can come into play. You can start looking at those and compare those with the investigations numbers. When are they committing these misconduct within their first 6 months in the company? Is it happening more frequently when they're 20 years in the company? So if you go through these factors, you start building a story by thinking about what other data points can fill in this story to answer all of these who, what, when, where, why questions. And Zach, I know we've done work with clients in precisely that kind of storytelling.
100%, but it's even more than just more effectively telling the who, what, when, why story. It's how you can use that data. Let's take investigations data, for example, to answer or to tell a story about something like, have we effectively mitigated risk, or to tell a story around, are our employees making good decisions, or does our compliance program work, or are our employees learning from the trainings that we're giving? Like, these are all stories that I think are on all of our minds as compliance people, and we can answer these questions with data. And so we should start by not saying, let's talk about ERP systems and let's talk about Excel spreadsheets and let's talk about data. We should just start by saying, okay, before we even get into a discussion about what data we need or have, or how it's structured, or how much confidence we have in it, what's the question we want to answer? Well, we want to answer the question, are our employees making good decisions? All right. Well, now let's talk about what data we need to answer that question.
I think also it's good to remember that there's lots of different stories that can be told by the exact same data. And I think about this from the sort of media landscape perspective of, if you have a local candidate for office, they're probably only covered by the local newspaper, the local radio, the local TV. Same area, if you have some member of Congress, they might be covered a little more broadly. They might be covered by a couple national newspapers who are focused on politics. Someone running for Senate might be a bigger race. And now you have a national story that's being told about that candidate, but you also have a local story that's being told about that candidate from those local media that might be focused more on individual issues in that community. Whereas the larger national or global publications that are reporting on that are going to be talking about the implications for the control of the legislature, for what it means for national policy or the types of votes that are going to happen if one or the other of those candidates gets elected. All of those are valid stories to be telling, but it's a difference of audience that you're trying to reach with that story and trying to find the things that are most important for that audience to tell in that story.
So allow me to do the translation for the ethics and compliance audience. You want to have your data storytelling in a way that different parts of your organization can engage with the data in a way that's relevant to them. So looking at the same data, the country manager of country X would have different interests in the same set of data as the global chief financial officer. And they're all looking at the same data, but you want to have your data story set up in a way that the country manager can go in and do whatever filtering that she needs to do and come up with an engagement with the data in a way that's relevant to her. And the global CFO can do the same thing with whatever is relevant to him. And you do this in a way that's customized for these different stakeholders so that they can get the story that interests them, that matters to them.
David, could you talk a little bit about a project that we recently did for a client where we were tasked with creating that kind of high level, but also filterable story around compliance performance, and specifically talk about how we framed the narrative into different buckets using various data points, but also framing or shaping individual KPIs that fell into several high-level buckets?
Absolutely. We came up with a whole framework for sort of nesting and overlapping all of the various concepts that you use to tell a data story, taking all of those pieces and interlocking them, overlapping them, putting them aside, putting them in opposition so that you can mix and match them and view them in all sorts of different ways that make sense. The most atomic item that we had in this system was a metric. All of those metrics rolled into analysis theories or analysis ideas. And those ideas were questions. And they were questions like, Zach, like you were just bringing up, is our compliance program working? Are our employees being non-compliant, or in what is the manner in which our employees are being non-compliant? And under each of those, we had various metrics that could help inform that question or that statement. And then all of those were inside of a framework around understanding the employee's conduct, understanding their knowledge, and understanding perceptions. Each analysis theory is having metrics that can drive them, now lets you pick at any one point the relevant pieces of your compliance program that you need to report on to your audience. You might have people who are interested in specific metrics. You might have people who are interested in specific questions or analysis theories. You might have people who are interested in various components or any sort of combination of those things. And now you can roll them all together and interlock them in a way that tells a cohesive story about your program that is relevant to your audience, rather than just saying, here's a bunch of numbers that we collect and aren't you interested in them? What made these metrics really powerful, though, was to ensure that our client was not just capturing the number, but capturing information about the number. So understanding what the normal range of that number is, or their comfortable range of that number. Obviously, organizations are human, and humans are variable. And so these metrics are just going to change from month to month, from week to week, from quarter to quarter, just by the fact of human nature. And so instead of saying, oh, the perfect number is 50, actually an acceptable number is between 40 and 60. And let's define that range for every single number that you're collecting. That range might be 0 to 60. And so you need to know how far above 60 should you be start getting more and more concerned. Where are those break points between something that's a little concerning versus needs immediate attention? And that can happen on both sides of those metrics. And so when we're talking about creating these comprehensive metrics, it's about adding in those features at the start and saying, we have numbers, we're collecting them, we're calculating them, and here's where we expect them to be, and here's where we start worrying about them. And so now, instead of just putting numbers in front of people, whether those people are your line managers or your CEO, they can see that, oh, this is an unacceptable place to be, or this is just an uncomfortable place to be.
We started by saying that we want to make sure we're telling stories with data, but also that we want to make sure that we're starting the discussion about how we're going to use our data, how we're going to cut our data, how we're going to analyze our data, framed around stories. And so that's exactly what's done here. We started by saying, well, what are the questions you want to answer? What are the stories you want to be able to tell? One of the questions that we wanted to be able to answer was, are our reporting channels operating as they should? That then becomes a level in and of itself. It's actually the middle level in the framework that you just articulated, right?
Yeah.
Above it sits a higher level designation of what do we know about our conduct? How are our people behaving? Then you've got that question of are the reporting channels operating as they should, along with a number of other questions that speak to conduct. And then under that, you have the individual metric, which could be the number of reports or the number of reports per X number of employees, the percentage that are anonymous, whatever the metric may be. What often happens, though, is that people start with those individual metrics and then they wind up putting together a bunch of metrics, as you said, and then they dump all of those metrics on people. So what I love about the framework that you created here is that we have these three different levels, each of which are giving an indicator in and of themselves. But even when we get down to that bottom level of the metric, it's not just a number. That number is being communicated in a way that says, this is good, this is bad, or this is indifferent. And being able to do that is a huge part of telling the story. Oftentimes we think of like good, bad, indifferent, of like a sliding scale where like good is on one side and bad is on the other. But that doesn't work for all of these metrics. So how do you deal with that?
Yes, sometimes that good scale is in the middle. In the investigations context, the sort of number of reports per employee is something that you don't want to be too low and you don't want to be too high. Too high, you have a lot of issues in your organization. Too low, and maybe people aren't speaking up enough. People aren't comfortable with your reporting program, or people don't know how to report things. And so just because a number is low doesn't mean it's good. You do need to try and understand when something should have a lower limit that's not zero. And in this system, we talked about related metrics that you should also look at. When this number is low, ensure that this number isn't, or that this number is as well. And that will help give you a fuller sense of what's happening in your program.
There are a couple of things that really jump out at me on this particular client work that you did. One is, I love the fact that your deliverable was called a blueprint, because again, as a layperson, I think of it in architectural terms. In the beginning of the conversation we had with this organization, it literally was basically saying, we have a lot of these datas and what do we do with them? So it's almost like somebody saying, we got a lot of bricks. Here they are. What do we do with them? And you delivered a blueprint that is the house that they want to build with all these bricks. Without the blueprint, it would just be piles of bricks. A blueprint, when you think about it like a story, is the house that you want to build. And so I really love that. The other concept that basically you're talking about is contextualizing the a lot of the data. So when you say information about the numbers, and I think this is again where people who are not comfortable with numbers or statistics can get lost in a lot of concepts. So I know when we have you in front of our training workshops, you go through certain concepts like causation and correlation, things like that. I think a lot of people can say things like, oh, causation does not equal correlation, but they do it all the time, despite their knowledge. It's constantly confused.
Take us to school. Let's start with correlation and why it's different from causation.
Yeah, so correlation is the idea that you can have two data sets that move in similar ways. A positive correlation would be every year around the time of performance reviews, the number of calls to our hotline go up as well. That the date of performance reviews is tied to the date of reports to the hotline. that is a feature that is seen at a lot of organizations, and it has to do with disgruntled employees finally being given a bad performance review, and the final straw is to report their boss for something. That is correlation. That is also causation. When you look into it and you say, this has caused that. But sometimes there are things that just happen to move in parallel with each other that aren't causal. It is complete happenstance that these things are tightly correlated.
One of my favorite examples of this, I think, came from one of these medical shows that I watch. All the doctors who are sitting in Grand Rounds, it's early morning, they're all drinking coffee. So whoever was the main character looked out and said, how many of you are doctors? They all raised their hands. Well, how many of you are drinking coffee? You know, like 90% of them raised their hands. So drinking coffee makes you doctors, right? That's a classic confusion of these two concepts. You're not looking at other factors, like how many other people who are not doctors who are also drinking coffee at this time. That's the failure to contextualize right there.
I think it underscores a really important point that all compliance professionals need to remember, which is that when we start making our programs more data-driven, we also naturally have to move away from binary thinking around good and bad, right and wrong, because that correlation may actually be reflective of causation, but you've got to ask additional questions. You've got to interrogate the data more. You've got to dig deeper to figure that out. And the spurious part of it is to just take it on its face. And that's exactly what you can't do as you start making your program more data-driven.
Companies love to ask the question about measuring the effectiveness of their policies and procedures or training and communications. There are many important things here, but one of the ones I immediately thought of was, this cannot be a one-time exercise. The first question is, what do you mean by effective, right? So what is your policy and procedure and training and communication trying to achieve? So assuming you're trying to achieve essentially good behavior, so a good compliance culture, we can assess that culture, but without comparison. Let's say we go into the company and we assess and they have a strong compliance culture. We don't know if this compliance culture existed before you had any compliance program, any training, any policy. That compliance culture may have nothing to do with your compliance program. If we don't do sort of these measurements over time, which is what you need to do in this type of contextualization, you really cannot answer the causation question. All you can do right at one point is the correlation, that you've done this number of, you know, training and communications exercises, you've revised your code of conduct, and at this point in time, you have a culture that looks like this. But is it because of your training and communications and all of those? We don't know. Because no baseline measurement was taken before you did any of the intervention. And we are just coming in, taking the temperature now. So there is really no way to answer the causation question at all without the sort of time over time measurement.
Absolutely. David, I like this game. Let's do another data concept for you to educate us on. How about magnitude?
Yeah, magnitude is just how big something is. Lots of people are used to reporting by magnitude. You have how many cases did you have this month? How many cases were about HR issues? That's just how many is magnitude, and putting it in scale with something else is sometimes looking at part to the whole, which would be another data concept, but oftentimes it's not. You're just giving the context of magnitude. We had 10 cases about HR issues, and we had 50 cases about expense issues. And so 5 times more is a magnitude.
All right, how about distribution?
Distribution is one that people do not use enough to tell stories with. Distribution is if we start grouping things together, what does the frequency of those things look like? One of the examples that we all like to give is talking about expenses and talking about expense limits. And if you create a chart of the distribution of per person dinner cost on the expenses in your organization, you will not have a normal distribution. You will have a big spike right under your limit. And that is because people view a meal limit as something to maximize towards rather than something to just prevent you from going over. And also because people play a game. There are lots of people who play games with their expenses because if they don't, they won't get repaid, or they'll be on the hook for some corporate expense that they weren't familiar enough with what the policy was, or there was a culture that enabled this sort of behavior to try and fit within some rule that is programmed, that's programmed into a system that prevents you from actually even filing your expenses if you have deviated from a policy.
All right, let's do one more. How about flow?
Flow is a really important one when you're trying to talk about a complicated way in which items move through processes, and that those items could be dollars, those items could be people, those items could be documents. The hiring process is a great use for talking about flow. We had this many people apply. Some segment of them, we moved on to the next stage. So of our first round people, we did a second level review of their resumes, of their cover letters, of their portfolios, whatever it is. And we interviewed some even smaller segment of them. And of those, we offered more interviews to them. We had finalists. All of this, this narrowing down of the funnel is not just a, actually, it's not actually just a one-way funnel that we talk about, oh, we have all of these applicants and it narrows down to finally the person that we hired. At each step of that filtering, there are people who are being spun out, and perhaps they're being spun out into other other roles that they're better suited for, or they're being categorized into some group of candidates for a future role if it were to open up, or a more junior role after a senior person gets hired. Keeping track of the whole system of people as you moved from the big cohort into the smaller cohorts as you filtered them is flow.
One of the things that I want to say here to folks who are listening to this, and who may be some of those who are not naturally sort of inclined or comfortable with data, the goal is to not make you a data scientist if you're not a data scientist. The goal is not to make the compliance or the human resources professional a data scientist. The goal is to make you more savvy, more sophisticated in your ability to sort of have conversations with the folks who do have those skill sets that can help you build this stuff.
Yeah, I talk about data concepts like this because it helps people frame the ideas that they're already having into concrete terms that they know how to communicate. The way in which you communicate a magnitude is different than the way in which you communicate a correlation. But until you give it a name, you might not make that leap and say, I have these two ideas in my head and I need to tell people about them. And you might start telling people about them in the same way, and your audience might not get it because they don't realize that in one case you're talking about how something has a big magnitude, and the other one you're talking about how something is really tightly correlated.
I also think it's important to get to a level of robust thinking where whatever you're presenting and the points that you're making are defensible. Because I think, for example, if somebody gets up without a time over time measurement and say, look, we've done a bunch of, you know, activities and we have this, you know, graph to show our strong compliance culture, you want to be able to defend the causation that you're implying there, that all of this, you know, this great culture is because of all the activities that you have conducted. In order to do that in a way that's business savvy, you're asking your stakeholders to invest in your activities. So you need to prove the value of those activities. You need to be able to stand up under scrutiny when people ask you hard questions about the investments that you're asking them to make. We're talking about beginning and middle and end. And so I like to see what some of the end looks like. You talked about compelling people into action. From having heard you present on this, I know by action you don't necessarily mean actions like we need to institute something, we need to, you know, fire people, promote people. So tell us what you mean by the kind of ending that a story would be provoking.
Yeah, I mean, you need your audience to be coming away with an appreciation for the thing that you're telling them. It might be the traditional action. It might be, yes, now I can sign this document. Now I can approve your budget. Now I will allocate more headcount to you. Now I will give you a promotion. These are all like things that when you present to someone, like, can happen immediately because you gave them the enough information to take an action. We're in a business context here. People need to make business decisions of all kinds throughout their day, especially your senior leaders. All they are doing is making decisions and enabling other people to make decisions. And so if you are giving them information that lets them make their decisions more informed and smarter and with less risk, or at the very least with a greater appreciation for the risks that are existing, you have helped improve the business. And hopefully your leaders have an appreciation for that. But if they don't, that's part of the story you also need to tell. And that in you knowing this information, you now understand our business so much better, that your decisions will be so much more informed, that we will be more successful, we will be more strategically aligned, we will be hitting our goals, and we are going to be closer to achieving everything we want to achieve because we all understand what is happening.
David, we've reached the end. What final words of encouragement or advice or just knowledge do you want to share with our listeners?
I like telling folks in compliance that they need to understand and create their version of a chart that goes up and to the right. That the leaders in your organization are used to seeing a sales team come in and show a chart that goes up and to the right. And the leader says, good job, team. The marketing team can do the same thing. An R&D team can do the same thing. They can show metrics that are on their face, understood by leaders to be good and showing a positive trend. And compliance teams are not yet great at that. And so to be able to come up with this chart, having your at a glance view of success that you can show a leader is going to be one of the most powerful things that you can do. And one of the most important reasons why data storytelling is going to be core to your message. Your colleagues in other functions are already telling their story through data, and your leaders are already used to consuming it. And so you have to meet your leaders where they are and tell the story in that way.
Terrific. David, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, David.
Thank you all for tuning in to the Better Way podcast and exploring all of these better ways with us. For more information about this or anything else that's happening with RNG Insights Lab, please visit our website at www.ropesgray.com/RG Insights Lab. You can also subscribe to this series wherever you regularly listen to podcasts, including on Apple and Spotify. And if you have thoughts about what we talked about today, the work the lab does, or just have ideas for better ways we should explore, please don't hesitate to reach out. We'd love to hear from you. Thanks again for listening.